Random House Audiobooks presents Sula by Toni Morrison. Read for you by the author.
Sula. In that place where they tore the nightshade and blackberry patches from their roots to make room for the Medallion City golf course, there was once a neighborhood. It stood in the hills above the valley town of Medallion and spread all the way to the river. It is called the suburbs now, but when black people lived there, it was called the bottom. One road, shaded by beeches, oaks, maples, and chestnuts, connected it to the valley. The beeches are gone now, and so are the pear trees, where children sat and yelled down through the blossoms to passers-by. Generous funds have been allotted to level the stripped and faded buildings that clutter the road from Medallion up to the golf course. They're going to raise the time and a half pool hall, where feet in long tan shoes once pointed down from chair rungs. A steel ball will knock to dust Irene's Palace of Cosmetology, where women used to lean their heads back on sink trays and doze while Irene lathered new Nile into their hair. Men in khaki work clothes will pry loose the slats of Reba's grill where the owner cooked in her hat because she couldn't remember the ingredients without it. There will be nothing left of the bottom. The footbridge that crossed the river is already gone, but perhaps it's just as well, since it wasn't a town anyway, just a neighborhood, where on quiet days, people in valley houses could hear singing sometimes, banjos sometimes, and if a valley man happened to have business up in those hills, collecting rent or insurance payments, he might see a dark woman in a flowered dress doing a bit of cakewalk, a bit of black bottom, a bit of messing around to the lively notes of a mouth organ. Her bare feet would raise the saffron dust that floated down on the coveralls and bunion-split shoes of the man breathing music in and out of his harmonica. The black people watching her would laugh and rub their knees, and it would be easy for the valley man to hear the laughter and not notice the adult pain that rested somewhere under the eyelids, somewhere under their head rags and soft felt hats, somewhere in the palm of the hand, somewhere behind the frayed lapel, somewhere in the sinew's curve. He'd have to stand in the back of Greater St. Matthew's and let the tenor's voice dress him in silk or touch the hands of the spoon carvers who had not worked in 8 years and let the fingers that danced on wood kiss his skin. Otherwise, the pain would escape him, even though the laughter was part of the pain. A shucking, knee-slapping, wet-eyed laughter that could even describe and explain how they came to be where they were. A joke. A nigger joke. That was the way it got started. Not the town, of course, but that part of town where the Negroes lived. The part they called the bottom, in spite of the fact that it was up in the hills. Just a nigger joke. The kind white folks tell when the mill closes down and they're looking for a little comfort somewhere. The kind colored folks tell on themselves when the rain doesn't come or comes for weeks and they're looking for a little comfort somehow. A good white farmer promised freedom and a piece of bottom land to his slave if he would perform some very difficult chores. When the slave completed the work, he asked the farmer to keep his end of the bargain. Freedom was easy. The farmer had no objection to that, but he didn't want to give up any land. So he told the slave that he was very sorry that he had to give him valley land. He had hoped to give him a piece of the bottom. The slave blinked and said he thought valley land was bottom land. The master said, "Oh, no. See those hills? That's bottom land, rich and fertile. But it's high up in the hills, said the slave. High up from us, said the master. But when God looks down, it's the bottom. That's why we call it so. It's the bottom of heaven, best land there is. So the slave pressed his master to try to get him some. He preferred it to the valley, and it was done. The nigger got the hilly land where planting was backbreaking, where the soil slid down and washed away the seeds, and where the wind lingered all through the winter, which accounted for the fact that white people lived on the rich valley floor in that little river town in Ohio, and the blacks populated the hills above it, taking small consolation in the fact that every day they could literally look down on the white folks. Still, it was lovely up in the bottom. After the town grew and the farmland turned into a village and the village into a town and the streets of Medallion were hot and dusty with progress, those heavy trees that sheltered the shacks up in the bottom were wonderful to see. And the hunters who went there sometimes wondered in private if maybe the white farmer was right after all. Maybe it was the bottom of heaven. The black people would have disagreed, but they had no time to think about it. They were mightily preoccupied with earthly things and each other, wondering even as early as 1920 what Shadrach was all about, what that little girl, Sula, who grew into a woman in their town was all about, and what they themselves were all about, tucked up there in the bottom. Except for World War II, nothing ever interfered with the celebration of National Suicide Day. It had taken place every January 3rd since 1920, although Shadrach, its founder, was for many years the only celebrant. Blasted and permanently astonished by the events of 1917, he had returned to Medallion, handsome but ravaged, and even the most fastidious people in the town sometimes caught themselves dreaming of what he must have been like a few years back before he went off to war. A young man of hardly 20, his head full of nothing and his mouth recalling the taste of lipstick, Shadrach had found himself in December 1917 running with his comrades across a field in France. It was his first encounter with the enemy, and he didn't know whether his company was running toward them or away. For several days they had been marching, keeping close to a stream that was frozen at its edges. At one point, they crossed it, and no sooner had he stepped foot on the other side than the day was a dangle with shouts and explosions. Shell fire was all around him, and though he knew that this was something called it, he could not muster up the proper feeling, the feeling that would accommodate it. He expected to be terrified or exhilarated, to feel something very strong. In fact, he felt only the bite of a nail in his boot, which pierced the ball of his foot whenever he came down on it. The day was cold enough to make his breath visible, and he wondered for a moment at the purity and whiteness of his own breath among the dirty gray explosions surrounding him. He ran, bayonet fixed, deep in the great sweep of men flying across this field. Wincing at the pain in his foot, he turned his head a little to the right and saw the face of a soldier near him fly off. Before he could register shock, the rest of the soldier's head disappeared under the inverted soup bowl of his helmet. But stubbornly, taking no direction from the brain, the body of the headless soldier ran on with energy and grace, ignoring altogether the drip and slide of brain tissue down its back. When Shadrach opened his eyes, He was propped up in a small bed. Before him on a tray was a large tin plate, divided into three triangles. In one triangle was rice, in another meat, and in the third stewed tomatoes. A small round depression held a cup of whitish liquid. Shadrach stared at the soft colors that filled these triangles, the lumpy whiteness of rice, the quivering blood tomatoes, the grayish-brown meat. All their repugnance was contained in the neat balance of the triangles, a balance that soothed him, transferred some of its equilibrium to him. Thus reassured that the white, the red, and the brown would stay where they were, would not explode or burst forth from their restricted zones, he suddenly felt hungry and looked around for his hands. His glance was cautious at first, for he had to be very careful. Anything could be anywhere. Then he noticed two lumps beneath the beige blanket on either side of his hips. With extreme care, he lifted one arm and was relieved to find his hand attached to his wrist. He tried the other and found it also. Slowly, he directed one hand toward the cup, and just as he was about to spread his fingers, they began to grow in higgledy-piggledy fashion like Jack's beanstalk all over the tray and the bed. With a shriek, he closed his eyes and thrust his huge, growing hands under the covers. Once out of sight, they seemed to shrink back to their normal size. But the yell had brought a male nurse. "Private, we're not going to have any trouble today, are we? Are we, Private?" Shadrach looked up at a balding man dressed in a green cotton jacket and trousers. His hair was parted low on the right side so that some 20 or 30 yellow hairs could discreetly cover the nakedness of his head. "Come on, pick up that spoon. Pick it up, Private. Nobody's going to feed you forever." Sweat slid from Shadrach's armpits down his sides. He could not bear to see his hands grow again, and he was frightened of the voice in the apple-green suit. "Pick it up," I said. "There's no point to this." The nurse reached under the cover for Shadrach's wrist to pull out the monstrous hand. Shadrach jerked it back and overturned the tray. In panic, he raised himself to his knees and tried to fling off and away his terrible fingers, but succeeded only in knocking the nurse into the next bed. When they bound Shadrach into a straitjacket, he was both relieved and grateful, for his hands were at last hidden and confined to whatever size they had attained. Laced and silent in his small bed, he tried to tie the loose cords in his mind. He wanted desperately to see his own face and connect it with the word "private," the word the nurse and the others who helped bind him had called him. Private, he thought, was something secret, and he wondered why they looked at him and called him a secret. Still, if his hands behaved as they had done, what might he expect from his face? The fear and longing were too much for him, so he began to think of other things. That is, he let his mind slip into whatever cave mouths of memory it chose. He saw a window that looked out on a river which he knew was full of fish. Someone was speaking softly just outside the door. Shadrach's earlier violence had coincided with a memorandum from the hospital executive staff in reference to the distribution of patients in high-risk areas. There was clearly a demand for space. The priority or the violence earned Shadrach his release. $217 in cash, a full suit of clothes, and copies of very official-looking papers. When he stepped out of the hospital door, the grounds overwhelmed him. The cropped shrubbery, the edged lawns, the undeviating walks. Shadrach looked at the cement stretches, each one leading clear-headedly to some presumably desirable destination. There were no fences, no warnings, no obstacles at all between concrete and green grass, so one could easily ignore the tidy sweep of stone and cut out in another direction, a direction of one's own. Shadrach stood at the foot of the hospital steps, watching the heads of trees tossing ruefully but harmlessly, since their trunks were rooted too deeply in the earth to threaten him. Only the walks made him uneasy. He shifted his weight, wondering how he could get to the gate without stepping on the concrete. While plotting his course, where he would have to leap, where to skirt a clump of bushes, a loud guffaw startled him. Two men were going up the steps. Then he noticed that there were many people about, and that he was just now seeing them, or else they had just materialized. They were thin slips like paper dolls, floating down the walks. Some were seated in chairs with wheels, propelled by other paper figures from behind. All seemed to be smoking, and their arms and legs curved in the breeze. A good high wind would pull them up and away, and they would land, perhaps, among the tops of the trees. Shadrach took the plunge, four steps, and he was on the grass, heading for the gate. He kept his head down to avoid seeing the paper people swerving and bending here and there, and he lost his way. When he looked up, he was standing by a low red building, separated from the main building by a covered walkway. From somewhere came a sweetish smell, which reminded him of something painful. He looked around for the gate and saw that he had gone directly away from it in his complicated journey over the grass. Just to the left of the low building was a gravel driveway that appeared to lead outside the grounds. He trotted quickly to it and left, at last, a haven of more than a year, only 8 days of which he fully recollected. Once on the road, he headed west. The long stay in the hospital had left him weak, too weak to walk steadily on the gravel shoulders of the road. He shuffled, grew dizzy, stopped for breath, started again, stumbling and sweating, but refusing to wipe his temples, still afraid to look at his hands. Passengers in dark, square cars shuttered their eyes at what they took to be a drunken man. The sun was already directly over his head when he came to a town. A few blocks of shaded streets, and he was already at its heart, a pretty, quietly regulated downtown. Exhausted, his feet clotted with pain, he sat down at the curbside to take off his shoes. He closed his eyes to avoid seeing his hands and fumbled with the laces of the heavy, high-topped shoes. The nurse had tied them into a double knot, the way one does for children, and Shadrach, long unaccustomed to the manipulation of intricate things, could not get them loose. Uncoordinated, his fingernails tore away at the knots. He fought a rising hysteria that was not merely anxiety to free his aching feet. His very life depended on the release of the knots. Suddenly, without raising his eyelids, he began to cry. 22 years old, weak, hot, frightened, not daring to acknowledge the fact that he didn't even know who or what he was, with no past, no language, no tribe, no source, no address book, no comb, no pencil, no clock, no pocket handkerchief, no rug, no bed, no can opener, no faded postcard, no soap, no key, no tobacco pouch, no soiled underwear, and nothing, nothing, nothing to do. He was sure of one thing only, the unchecked monstrosity of his hands. He cried soundlessly at the curbside of a small Midwestern town, wondering where the window was, and the river, and the soft voices just outside the door. Through his tears, he saw the fingers joining the laces, tentatively at first, then rapidly, the four fingers of each hand fused into the fabric, knotted themselves and zigzagged in and out of the tiny eye hole. By the time the police drove up, Shadrach was suffering from a blinding headache, which was not abated by the comfort he felt when the policeman pulled his hands away from what he thought was a permanent entanglement with his shoelaces. They took him to jail, booked him for vagrancy and intoxication, and locked him in a cell. Lying on a cot, Shadrach could only stare helplessly at the wall, so paralyzing was the pain in his head. He lay in this agony for a long while, and then realized he was staring at the painted-over letters of a command to fuck himself. He studied the phrase as the pain in his head subsided. Like moonlight stealing under a window shade, an idea insinuated itself, his earlier desire to see his own face. He looked for a mirror. There was none. Finally, keeping his hands carefully behind his back, he made his way to the toilet bowl and peeped in. The water was unevenly lit by the sun, so he could make nothing out. Returning to his cot, he took the blanket and covered his head, rendering the water dark enough to see his reflection. There, in the toilet water, he saw a grave black face, a black so definite, so unequivocal, it astonished him. He had been harboring a skittish apprehension that he was not real, that he didn't exist at all. But when the blackness greeted him with its indisputable presence, he wanted nothing more. In his joy, he took the risk of letting one edge of the blanket drop and glanced at his hands. They were still, courteously still. Shadrach rose and returned to the cot, where he fell into the first sleep of his new life, a sleep deeper than the hospital drugs, deeper than the pits of plums, steadier than the condor's wing, more tranquil than the curve of eggs. The sheriff looked through the bars at the young man with the matted hair. He had read through his prisoner's papers and hailed a farmer. When Shadrach awoke, the sheriff handed him back his papers and escorted him to the back of a wagon. Shadrach got in, and in less than 3 hours he was back in Medallion, for he had been only 22 miles from his window, his river, and his soft voices just outside the door. In the back of the wagon, supported by sacks of squash and hills of pumpkins, Shadrach began a struggle that was to last for 12 days, a struggle to order and focus experience. It had to do with making a place for fear as a way of controlling it. He knew the smell of death and was terrified of it, for he could not anticipate it. It was not death or dying that frightened him, but the unexpectedness of both. In sorting it all out, he hit on the notion that if one day a year were devoted to it, everybody could get it out of the way, and the rest of the year would be safe and free. In this manner, he instituted National Suicide Day. On the third day of the new year, he walked through the bottom, down Carpenter's Road, with a cowbell and a hangman's rope, calling the people together, telling them that this was their only chance to kill themselves or each other. At first, the people in the town were frightened. They knew Shadrach was crazy, but that didn't mean that he didn't have any sense, or even more important, that he had no power. His eyes were so wild, his hair so long and matted, his voice so full of authority and thunder, that he caused panic on the first, or charter, National Suicide Day in 1920. The next one, in 1921, was less frightening, but still worrisome. The people had seen him a year now in between. He lived in a shack on the riverbank that had once belonged to his grandfather, long time dead. On Tuesday and Friday, he sold the fish he had caught that morning. The rest of the week, he was drunk, loud, obscene, funny, and outrageous. But he never touched anybody, never fought, never caressed. Once the people understood the boundaries and nature of his madness, they could fit him, so to speak, into the scheme of things. Then, on subsequent National Suicide Days, the grown people looked out from behind curtains as he rang his bell. A few stragglers increased their speed, and little children screamed and ran. The tetterheads tried goading him, although he was only 4 or 5 years older than they. But not for long, for his curses were stingingly personal. As time went along, the people took less notice of these January 3rds, or rather they thought they did, thought they had no attitudes or feelings one way or another about Shadrach's annual solitary parade. In fact, they had simply stopped remarking on the holiday because they had absorbed it into their thoughts, into their language, into their lives. Someone said to a friend, "He sure was a long time delivering that baby. How long was you in labor?" And the friend answered, "About 3 days. The pain started on Suicide Day and kept up till the following Sunday. Was born on Sunday. All my boys is Sunday boys." Some lover said to his bride-to-be, "Let's do it after New Year's instead of before. I get paid New Year's Eve." And his sweetheart answered, "Okay, but make sure it ain't on Suicide Day. I ain't about to be listening to no cowbells whilst the wedding's going on." Somebody's grandmother said her hens always started a laying of double yolks right after Suicide Day. Then Reverend Deal took it up, saying the same folks who had sense enough to avoid Shadrach's call were the ones who insisted on drinking themselves to death or womanizing themselves to death. May as well go on with Shad and save the lamb the trouble of redemption. Easily, quietly, Suicide Day became a part of the fabric of life up in the bottom of Medallion, Ohio. It had to be as far away from the sundown house as possible. And her grandmother's middle-aged nephew, who lived in a northern town called Medallion, was the one chance she had to make sure it would be. The red shutters had haunted both Helene Sabat and her grandmother for 16 years. Helene was born behind those shutters, daughter of a Creole whore who worked there. The grandmother took Helene away from the soft lights and flowered carpets of the sundown house and raised her under the dulsome eyes of a multicolored Virgin Mary, counseling her to be constantly on guard for any sign of her mother's wild blood. So when Wiley Wright came to visit his great-aunt Cecile in New Orleans, his enchantment with the pretty Helene became a marriage proposal under the pressure of both women. He was a seaman, or rather a lake man, for he was a ship's cook on one of the Great Lakes lines, in port only 3 days out of every 16. He took his bride to his home in Medallion and put her in a lovely house with a brick porch and real lace curtains at the window. His long absences were quite bearable for Helene Wright, especially when, after some 9 years of marriage, her daughter was born. Her daughter was more comfort and purpose than she had ever hoped to find in this life. She rose grandly to the occasion of motherhood, grateful deep down in her heart that the child had not inherited the great beauty that was hers, that her skin had dusk in it, that her lashes were substantial but not undignified in their length, that she had taken the broad, flat nose of Wiley, although Helene expected to improve it somewhat, and his generous lips. Under Helene's hand, the girl became obedient and polite. Any enthusiasms that little Nell showed were calmed by the mother until she drove her daughter's imagination underground. Helene Wright was an impressive woman, at least in Medallion she was. Heavy hair in a bun, dark eyes arched in a perpetual query about other people's manners. A woman who won all social battles with presence and a conviction of the legitimacy of her authority. Since there was no Catholic church in Medallion then, she joined the most conservative black church and held sway. It was Helene who never turned her head in church when latecomers arrived. Helene who established the practice of seasonal altar flowers. Helene who introduced the giving of banquets of welcome to returning Negro veterans. She lost only one battle, the pronunciation of her name. The people in the bottom refused to say Helene. They called her Helen Wright and left it at that. All in all, her life was a satisfactory one. She loved her house and enjoyed manipulating her daughter and her husband. She would sigh sometimes just before falling asleep, thinking that she had indeed come far enough away from the sundown house. So it was with extremely mixed emotions that she read a letter from Mr. Henri Barton describing the illness of her grandmother and suggesting she come down right away. She didn't want to go, but she could not bring herself to ignore the silent plea of the woman who had rescued her. It was November 1920. Even in Medallion there was a victorious swagger in the legs of white men and a dull-eyed excitement in the eyes of colored veterans. Helene thought about the trip south with heavy misgiving, but decided that she had the best protection, her manner and her bearing, to which she would add a beautiful dress. She bought some deep brown wool and 3/4 of a yard of matching velvet. Out of this, she made herself a heavy but elegant dress with velvet collar and pockets. Nell watched her mother cutting the pattern from newspapers and moving her eyes rapidly from a magazine model to her own hands. She watched her turn up the kerosene lamp at sunset, and so far into the night. The day they were ready, Helene cooked a smoked ham, left a note for her lake-bound husband in case he docked early, and walked head high and arms stiff with luggage ahead of her daughter to the train depot. It was a longer walk than she remembered, and they saw the train steaming up just as they turned the corner. They ran along the track, looking for the coach pointed out to them by the colored porter. Even at that, they made a mistake. Helene and her daughter entered a coach peopled by some 20 white men and women. Rather than go back and down the 3 wooden steps again, Helene decided to spare herself some embarrassment and walk on through to the colored car. She carried 2 pieces of luggage and a string purse. Her daughter carried a covered basket of food. As they opened the door marked colored only, they saw a white conductor coming toward them. It was a chilly day, but a light skim of sweat glistened on the woman's face as she and the little girl struggled to hold the door open, hang on to their luggage, and enter all at once. The conductor let his eyes travel over the pale yellow woman and then stuck his little finger into his ear, jiggling it free of wax. "What you think you're doing, gal?" Helene looked up at him. "So soon?" So soon. She hadn't even begun the trip back to her grandmother's house in the city, where the red shutters glowed, and already she had been called Gal. All the old vulnerabilities, all the old fears of being somehow flawed, gathered in her stomach and made her hands tremble. She had heard only that one word. It dangled above her wide brimmed hat, which had slipped in her exertion from its carefully leveled placement and was now tilted in a bit of a jaunt over her eye. Thinking he wanted her tickets, she quickly dropped both the cowhide suitcase and the straw one in order to search for them in her purse. An eagerness to please and an apology for living met in her voice. "I have them right here somewhere, sir." The conductor looked at the bit of wax his fingernail had retrieved. "What was you doing back in there? What was you doing in that coach yonder?" Helene licked her lips. "Oh, I..." Her glance moved beyond the white man's face to the passengers seated behind him. 4 or 5 black faces were watching, 2 belonging to soldiers, still in their shit-colored uniforms and peaked caps. She saw their closed faces, their locked eyes, and turned for compassion to the gray eyes of the conductor. "We made a mistake, sir. You see, there wasn't no sign. We just got in the wrong car, that's all, sir." "We don't allow no mistakes on this train. Now get your butt on in there." He stood there, staring at her, until she realized that he wanted her to move aside. Pulling Nell by the arm, she pressed herself and her daughter into the foot space in front of a wooden seat. Then, for no earthly reason, at least no reason that anybody could understand, certainly no reason that Nell understood, then or later, she smiled like a street pup that wags its tail at the very door jamb of the butcher shop he has been kicked away from only moments before. Helene smiled. Smiled dazzlingly and coquettishly at the salmon-colored face of the conductor. Nell looked away from the flash of pretty teeth to the other passengers. The 2 black soldiers, who had been watching the scene with what appeared to be indifference, now looked stricken. Behind Nell was the bright and blazing light of her mother's smile. Before her, the midnight eyes of the soldiers. She saw the muscles of their faces tighten, a movement under the skin from blood to marble. No change in the expression of the eyes, but a hard wetness that veiled them as they looked at the stretch of her mother's foolish smile. As the door slammed on the conductor's exit, Helene walked down the aisle to a seat. She looked about for a second to see whether any of the men would help her put the suitcases in the overhead rack. Not a man moved. Helene sat down fussily, her back toward the men. Nell sat opposite, facing both her mother and the soldiers, neither of whom she could look at. She felt both pleased and ashamed to sense that these men, unlike her father, who worshipped his graceful, beautiful wife, were bubbling with a hatred for her mother that had not been there in the beginning, but had been born with a dazzling smile. In the silence that preceded the train's heave, she looked deeply at the folds of her mother's dress. There in the fall of the heavy brown wool, she held her eyes. She could not risk letting them travel upward, for fear of seeing that the hooks and eyes in the placket of the dress had come undone and exposed the custard-colored skin underneath. She stared at the hem, wanting to believe in its weight, but knowing that custard was all that it hid. If this tall, proud woman, this woman who was very particular about her friends, who slipped into church with unequaled elegance, who could quell a roustabout with a look, if she were really custard, then there was a chance that Nell was too. It was on that train, shuffling toward Cincinnati, that she resolved to be on guard, always. She wanted to make certain that no man ever looked at her that way, that no midnight eyes or marbled flesh would ever accost her and turn her into jelly.